ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Before we get started, just a warning. This program contains some confronting themes, so take care when listening. It's July 2021, and Trish needs help. In recent weeks, she lost the ability to speak. Trish has motor neurone disease, and the only way she can communicate is by blinking. And now, she needs help from hospital staff to convey a message. Her daughter Mickey is begging the hospital to help, but they're being difficult.
It really shocked me that a publicly funded hospital could in any way create barriers.
Mickey knows what her mum is trying to say, but under the law, it's something only Trish herself can ask for. She wants to die. This is against the ethics of the hospital, and that's why it's refusing to facilitate this conversation.
I was basically told that they wouldn't be part of the conversation with the doctor. So I didn't know what to do, and I was really distressed. It really sent a message that what we were doing was wrong.
Voluntary assisted dying laws have been in effect in Victoria since 2019, and they're currently undergoing a 5-year review. They've also been rolled out in all states across Australia. But accessing voluntary assisted dying, or VAD, can be harder than you might think. Hospitals and palliative care units can refuse to facilitate VAD if they have ethical objections. And that can mean terminally ill patients face barriers to access right when they're at the most vulnerable.
Someone like my mum, who can't talk, can't move, can't advocate for themselves, is facing just about as many barriers as a person can face. So every little hurdle that's added to that is just an enormous stress to overcome.
When I meet Mickey at her home, she stops in the hallway and gazes into a bedroom. It's stacked floor to ceiling with boxes, her mum's entire life. But Mickey can't bear to face it just yet.
She was originally a dance teacher, and she was a teacher librarian later in her life.
But in 2019, Mickey noticed she was starting to have falls and showing weakness in one of her arms.
Which just made absolutely no sense to me, because 12 months prior, my mum had painted her whole house on a stepladder. And she was very active, very physically fit, had no health issues.
After her mum had a bad fall, Mickey joined a consult with the neurologist.
And that's when he said, "I think your mum has motor neuron disease." And we were both just in complete shock. I never thought that it would affect someone in my family. I'm my mum's only child. And we don't have really any close family. So it was really just she and I trying to work out what to do. She was living in Hayborough in South Australia. I've lived in Melbourne since 2017.
They were told that Melbourne was the best place for Mickey's mum to get the care she needed.
Through the Progressive Neurological Diseases Clinic at Calvary Bethlehem.
They also knew that in Melbourne, she would be able to access voluntary assisted dying.
And that wasn't an option for her in South Australia. So we decided to move her over.
But soon after her mum began treatment at Calvary Bethlehem, they discovered that despite being a public hospital, it would not take part in VAD.
On the first appointment, my mum asked about voluntary assisted dying, and straight away we basically got told, we can't talk to you about that. We're not involved with that. We'll provide care alongside of that, but we can't be involved with it.
But Calvary Bethlehem is Melbourne's main provider of motor neurone disease care, and Mickey just didn't know where else to go.
We were never spoken to about whether there were alternative options for her care that would be better able to support her desire to apply for VAD.
They faced an impossible choice. The best care for Mickey's mum or the death she wanted.
We were in a really tricky situation. As soon as you asked a question, even if it had nothing to do with voluntary assisted dying, if you mentioned that, they would just shut down. So it made it really difficult because we needed all the support we could get and we needed the care and information to be integrated. And as soon as we got to speaking about voluntary assisted dying, it was like hitting a brick wall.
Mickey's mother could have moved hospitals, but by the time she was ready to make her application, her health had deteriorated. Moving to a new hospital just seemed like an unnecessary trauma, and the pair were exhausted.
I just felt like I was constantly fighting that entire time, fighting to get the right information, fighting to get the right care. We had endured lockdowns. So on one side of that lockdown, my mum was able to hug me, and the next time I saw her, she couldn't. And because my mum had come from South Australia, she wasn't eligible to apply for voluntary assisted dying for 12 months. And by the time that 12 months passed, my mum was completely paralysed, unable to speak.
And that's when Mickey was left begging the hospital to help her mum make her request. By then, Trish could only communicate by blinking at a letterboard, spelling out words letter by letter. But the hospital refused to send a staffer with the equipment. So Mickey fought back. It escalated all the way to the hospital CEO. And eventually, special permission was granted for a staffer to attend, with limitations.
They could go in and set my mum up with the equipment, but they were not to be present in the room for any conversations.
As the staffer stood outside as instructed, Mickey's mum spent hours blinking out her request to die. And then Mickey waited. And with every passing day, her mum got sicker. Finally, they got a call. Her application for VAD had been approved.
And it felt like this moment of, I guess, just relief, because my mum had felt so powerless and unheard. She'd had no agency, no voice, literally and figuratively. This was the one thing that gave her back some control and power. She felt relieved just to have that medication there, whether she used it or not. She had chosen a date. It was 3 days after my birthday because she didn't want to ruin my birthday. She was really unwell. I just didn't know how to be, because part of me felt like I should stay there all night. Like, how do you go home the night before? So that night, I stayed later than usual. And I told her I didn't want her to go, but I wanted her to do what she wanted. And so we said goodnight. I was later told that if my mum hadn't used the medication, she probably would have died of pneumonia. And, yeah, that would have been a really traumatic death for her. So, you know, it was in the nick of time, I guess, that she got her approval through.
Calvary Bethlehem is one of 21 public Catholic hospitals around Australia who all refuse to be involved with VAD. It's called conscientious objection, and it's allowed under VAD laws. Calvary declined to speak with us for this program. It said in a statement that it responds openly, sensitively, and respectfully to anyone who wishes to explore VAD, and that it would not block a person's access. it confirmed the team that dealt with Mickey's mum was following Calvary's procedure of not being present for assessments nor the undertaking of VAD. And you'll find similar policies across the Catholic organisations that make up much of the palliative care sector. But opposition to VAD is not limited to Catholic organisations. These blanket policies also exist in secular palliative care centres. Hello. Hi. How are you?
Sorry, it's very dark out here.
That's okay. It's so peaceful. Like Mickey's, Julius's mum got sick during the pandemic, but with cancer.
Mum then had a sort of an incident at her home where she sort of fell out of bed and couldn't get back into bed. She was taken to hospital and her oncologist basically said that mum couldn't go back home.
Julius's mum was sent to One Turner, a public palliative care centre in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne.
I got a telephone call from my mum. She knew that I was coming down on the weekend, but she made a point of ringing me and said, look, I need to talk to you.
Julius drives to One Turner and goes to his mum's room.
And she said, look, I've been thinking about this and, I want to die. And I said to her, look, you know, we'll support you in whatever you want to do.
So Julius looks around the facility for someone to tell, and then he spies his mum's doctor.
I said, look, I need to speak to you. You know, my mother has expressed to me that she wishes to use sort of voluntary assisted dying. And then his reaction was, you know, it took me by surprise because he then scolded me and tried to say, to remind me that I was not to encourage my mum to do this. And I was distressed and upset by him making that sort of accusation that I would do that. And I confronted him and I told him so. And then he was silent. He didn't try to console me or didn't try to say, look, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to give you the wrong impression. There was nothing like that. It was just like, you know, stone.
Legally, there's no obligation for this doctor to refer people like Julius onto a service that might be able to help.
I was left feeling that I had nowhere to go after I spoke to that one person. I rang Mum's oncologist and she sort of knew that what the issues were and she said, okay, we're going to organise her to come back to the Epworth.
Epworth was the hospital that had sent her to the palliative care centre. Now she had to go back there. Julius didn't know it, but what happened with his mother wasn't an isolated case. One Turner, despite being non-religious, had refused to facilitate VAD for other patients too. So patients determined to access assisted dying were forced to go somewhere else.
They have no right to stop people from accessing that kind of service because it's legal.
And this wasn't just frustrating for patients and their relatives.
I have a large private practice in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne and work across three hospitals. By the way, my name is Prasad Kure.
Prasad Kure is an oncologist who specialises in some of the hardest-to-treat cancers. He has a calm and soothing presence, which must help in those difficult conversations with his patients. The way he sees it, he's not treating his patients. He's in a partnership with them.
I treat it as a privilege that I'm in that position to be able to help these people.
But when his patients lose the battle with cancer, the main public hospice he has to send them to is One Turner Palliative Care Unit. He's watched as his patients have been transferred out after requesting VAD, just like Julius's mum.
A dying patient is unstable. They could be medically unstable, unwell to be transferred. Very often in my care, we don't transfer unwell dying patients purely for the reasons of comfort.
His biggest fear has been that one of his patients would die in the back of an ambulance during a transfer.
It takes away dignity and it adds distress to these last moments of their lives. unnecessary distress. They've been in a facility for so many number of days or weeks. They've become used to that place. They've made connections with the staff, family are allowed to be around. And then all of a sudden that gets taken away because you've got to be admitted to an acute medical facility for this last bit. It's completely unacceptable.
Wantirna is a secular facility, and Prasad says patients have been shocked to find themselves transferred.
My own patients, when they discovered that they are not allowed to have VAD in that premise, they asked me, what can we do about this? So then we need to work out a plan B.
The other public palliative care centre he sometimes sends patients to is Caritas Christi, which is a Catholic organisation. And while it doesn't transfer patients, it has other limitations around assisted dying. That leaves the acute medical wards of local hospitals, which are not intended for palliative care.
The acute care hospital wards are set up for acutely ill patients. It's one step down from emergency department. So you're not in a place that's designed for people who are dying. Palliative care places are larger, more open, more natural light. There's no machines carting around, no blood being drawn every so often. So these institutions exist for the benefit and for serving the patients. And I do not understand how it's been flipped around, that it exists to serve the conscientious objections of staff, not the patients.
Prasad said the local health authority was well aware of the problem.
There's been internal reviews and recommendations, but that hasn't made a difference.
After our interview, things did finally change. I discovered a patient's family complained about Wantirna to Victoria's VAD board, and that triggered an investigation by the local health district, Eastern Health. It recently issued new guidelines mandating that VAD be accessible at all sites, including Wantirna. Eastern Health didn't want to be interviewed, but it said in a statement, "We have and will continue to respect the rights of conscientious objectors, including our staff." It also said its operational approach to supporting VAD has been updated over the years, including the recent appointment of a clinical director of VAD. It's too late for Prasad's previous patients, but it will help the next group who want to choose VAD.
When someone's diagnosed with not any cancer, but a terminal cancer, that's probably the most disempowering thing that can happen to an individual. When it comes to the end, when someone's battled as hard as they could, all these things are much more heightened. They're more disempowered. They're about to lose their life. And we tend to pay more attention and value to what flowers they would want in their funeral than how they would like to die. We have a duty to give them the agency and ownership of what the death looks like now. If my belief system gets in the way of your dying experience, I think that's a societal problem. As a community, we need to solve that.
I'm Dr. Eugene Joseph Moylan. I'm a medical oncologist at Liverpool Hospital. And what else did you need to know?
Just like Prasad, Eugene has worked with cancer patients for decades. His eyes light up as he speaks of how far treatments have come in that time. And also like Prasad, he says he tries to heal his patients not just with medicines, but with his humanity too. But Eugene and Prasad have very different perspectives on how to show their humanity when it comes to their patients' end-of-life wishes. Because Eugene fears that in pursuit of a good death, patients might die when they don't have to. It's a concern that's been shaped by his experiences over the years. He tells me about one of his patients who was referred to him in 2019, before assisted dying laws came into effect in New South Wales.
So this was a lady who had a particular type of breast cancer, HER2-positive breast cancer. The scan, the MRI scan, said that it looked like it was progression of the cancer. We treated her with some chemotherapy drugs in order to try and address that. And she just got worse during that time. So I thought the report from the MRI was that it was progressing. The report from me clinically was that she was progressing. And so I said, look, we should stop the treatment. I thought that she was really on death's door.
But then an unexpected turn of events.
She then moved to the Port Macquarie area and basically just kept living. And nearly 2 years later, then ultimately did develop real progression.
The patient died almost 2 years after Eugene thought she would. He claims he has a couple of experiences like this every year, and it's made him ask himself, what if I sign off on someone's death when they still have years to live? A few months after the patient's death, a parliamentary inquiry considered making VAD available in New South Wales. It would be people like Eugene certifying that applicants had less than 6 months to live. To him, it felt like being asked to play God. So he travelled from his hospital on the outskirts of Sydney to the Parliament House building on Macquarie Street.
First, Dr. Moylan.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And he took the stand.
In this inquiry, the Voluntary Assisted Dying Bill 2021 assumes that doctors can reliably and accurately predict life expectancy for cancer patients within a six-month time frame. That is patently incorrect. I believe that our laws need to protect the vulnerable for the benefit of society as a whole.
But Eugene felt like nobody was listening. None of the questions the committee asked were related to what he'd just told them. VAD was a foregone conclusion, he thought, and they were simply going through the motions. 6 months later, the VAD bill passed in that same parliament. And Eugene had to decide what to do when his patients asked him to sign off on their assisted dying applications. So he made a decision. He became a conscientious objector.
I'm not going to be writing a certificate to say that I believe somebody's got this long to live.
But that presents its own problem. Now his patients must find a doctor who's even less familiar with their case to sign off on their application.
And they don't have to be oncologists, or they don't have to be neurologists. They don't have to know the patient at all. You know, obviously they will get some documentation. If you're a protagonist, how vigilant are you in chasing down the detail? How, you know, if you see a report that says somebody's got metastatic cancer, is that sufficient?
VAD became available in New South Wales late last year. Then, in February, one of Eugene's patients asked about ending her life, and his objection was put to the test.
She had had a really tough time during that first month of treatment. And she said to me, you know, like, I don't want to keep living like this, you know, what do you think about, you know, voluntary assisted dying? And I said, we can adjust the treatment. It doesn't have to be toxic. And then she came back to me the next month and said, oh, I'm really pleased that I restarted it at the lower dose as you suggested. Life's so much better. I'm not really thinking about, you know, ending my life. And so that's the whole thing, is that people will always be reaching a crisis and perhaps be vulnerable to the suggestion that they need to end their life quickly. And if, you know, you facilitate it and you make it all happen in a hurry, you know, then potentially people can be ending their lives unnecessarily early and could have had spend significant amount of time with their family and friends.
While he won't be involved himself, Eugene says he will always refer a patient onto the VAD navigators within the hospital, who'll find doctors who aren't opposed to VAD.
I'll always do that. That's my professional role.
In some departments of Liverpool Hospital, objection is more pronounced than others. Eugene says most of the conscientious objection he knows of is in the palliative care team.
palliative care physicians. They believe strongly in supporting patients through suffering, you know, to a natural death.
So I put to him the experiences I've been hearing about patients in palliative care centres opposed to VAD.
Some of the people I've been speaking to in Victoria, so what they're finding is that there's palliative care centres like the one you mentioned where all of the doctors are objecting, and they're transferring patients home as a result if they obtain a permit. What do you think about transferring patients home when they're critically ill like that?
If you want to end your life, the question is, you know, should that be happening within a public hospital? You know, should we be facilitating assisted suicide, you know, within a public hospital? Is that a good use of our resources? You're not requesting more medical care. You're actually just wanting to kill yourself.
I think the problem is that they're being transferred as soon as they get a permit, and that might not be when they want to use the medication.
Oh, so is the fact that somebody wishes to avail themselves of assisted suicide, is that a reason for us to withdraw the best supportive care that we can? Then no, that would be a very bad error on our part. No, absolutely not.
The family member that I spoke to, someone who used VAD, and she came up against conscientious objection at the hospital, and she said it made them feel like they were doing something wrong and like they should feel very guilty and ashamed of what they were doing. Do you ever worry about that with your patients?
I haven't really thought about it in that way. I would not want anyone to feel guilty for ever having raised the idea that life was getting tough for them, intolerable for them. So to me, yeah, we have to be open. I'm open to them asking me the question. That, you know, they have to be open to the idea that perhaps I'm not so keen on the way that they wish to end their life. It's that tension between how do you give people what they want, what's good for the society as a whole, and voluntary assisted dying, when you think about it, is absolutely great for the individual, but the impact on society, you know, that's not so great, and that's where, you know, conscientious objection comes from, is really about our major concerns about the impact on society as a whole rather than just the individual, because nothing is about just the individual.
In February, Mickey sat down at her kitchen table to write out her story. It's been 5 years since VAD was introduced in Victoria, and the government wanted to hear people's experiences. So she wrote about her battle for Calvary Bethlehem to help convey her mum's request to die.
Terminally ill people don't have time or energy to fight institutions. They need care and support, and they need to be enabled, and it needs to be as seamless as possible and as integrated as possible.
Regardless of what the review discovers, the Victorian government has ruled out changing its laws, but it could change how they're enacted overnight. And that goes for other states too. Mickey just hopes that other families won't face the hurdles her mum did.
I'm grateful that voluntary assisted dying has been legalised, but there are a lot of other changes that need to be made for it to work in the way that it should.
If this story has raised any issues for you, you can speak to someone from Lifeline on 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. Background Briefing sound producers are Lila Schunner and Ingrid Wagner. Sound engineering by John Jacobs. Fact-checking by Ben Sveen. Our supervising producer is Mario Christodoulou. The executive producer is Fanu Fulali. And I'm Annika Blau. You can subscribe to Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app. Thanks for listening.
you're listening to Background Briefing, I reckon you'll enjoy another story that digs deep. Spies, lies and deception in an outback Australian town.
Officially, it's an experimental space station.
The country's most secretive spy base is hidden on the fringe of Alice Springs.
It's a killing machine on somebody else's land.
It's shaped a town, transformed war and continues to expand. Come with me, Alex Barwick, to find out what on earth is happening in my backyard.
Why are there secrets that we shouldn't know? What are they?
Spies in the Outback. Check it out and subscribe on the ABC Listen app.